Good morning. This is a live reading of the Green Valley News for February 12th, 2025. My name is Mark DeGroft. Good to have you aboard this Wednesday morning. High today, 63 degrees. Low tonight is 40. Humidity currently 41%. Cloud coverage is at 59. Winds are out of the southwest at 15. 1% chance of rain today. Sunrise was at 7:08:15. Tonight it goes away at 6:08:31. It's currently 49 degrees in Sorita Green Valley. Tomorrow, 72. Friday, 69. Saturday, looking at 65. Sunday, 75. And Monday, 77. Okay, from Phoenix, was the century-old Cow Palace restaurant destroyed by a 2018 flood because the Arizona Department of Transportation didn't maintain the Sapori Wash for 30 years, or because Amada was hit by the worst rainstorm in recorded history and the restaurant was in a floodplain? That'll be up to Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Christopher Witten to decide. On Tuesday, day two of what will likely be a six-day trial, Witten spent the morning listening to three witnesses who worked for the Pima County Regional Flood Control District at the time of the flood. They were Andy Dinauer, Eric Shep, and Joseph Kafari. Now retired, Dinauer was the co-deputy director of the district along with Shep in 2018. Dinauer testified that after looking at Google Map images of the Sapori Bridge taken after the flood, along with pictures that his staff had taken, he was, quote, curious, end quote. One of the pictures showed a 5-foot-8-inch tall Kafari standing on a huge mound of sediment only a few feet from the underside of the bridge. My observation was that I should alert my brethren at Santa Cruz County and ADOT to take a look. It was an area of concern, he said. He sent an email to both entities on October 4, 2018, because he wasn't sure who was responsible for maintaining the bridge. Dinauer was prohibited from testifying what response he received. In fact, much of Dinauer and Shep's testimony was precluded because they never visited the site, and their opinions would have been based only on reports and observations that were made by Kafari and another employee, Mindy Cox. During the depositions, both men testified that the flood caused by the buildup of sediment and vegetation under the bridge. While cross-examined by the state's attorneys, Kafari acknowledged a large amount of the sediment under the bridge had been washed away during the flood, leaving the Sapori Wash deeper and wider. And Shep, who is the district's director now, also acknowledged that the Cow Palace had been in a floodplain since either 1983 or 1989. Anticipating a possible appeal, Witten told plaintiff's attorney Michael Pauly to submit a document showing what the three men would have testified to had he not granted a defense motion limiting their testimony. Witten heard opening statements and a handful of witnesses in the case on Monday. Pauly, who represents Cow Palace owner Frank Bertolino, told the judge the case is about neglect and common sense. The plaintiffs plan to submit ADOT reports going back decades that show that the bridge inspectors repeatedly said the cells or culverts under the Sapori Bridge were filling up with silt and vegetation and more than once recommended that they be cleaned out, including just 5 months before the September 2, 2018 flood, Pauly said. In 2008 and again in 2010, inspectors pointed out that even large trees were growing under the bridge. Our evidence will show the water backed up at the bridge because no one had cleaned out those openings for 30 years, not 10 years, not 20 years, but 30 years. If there hadn't been sediment blocking the cells, the water that came crashing through the Cow Palace, leaving mud marks on the walls 4 feet high, toppling furniture and appliances, would have been minimalized or even eliminated, Pauly said. But because of everything blocking the culverts under the bridge, the water from the first rain cell that hit between 9 and 10 p.m. hadn't cleared by the time the second cell struck at 10 to 11 p.m., 7 miles upstream from the Cal Palace, according to Pulley. As a result, the water had no place to go but up the banks of Sapori Wash into the Cal Palace and other nearby businesses, he said. This is common sense. Water will go to lower elevations unless it's obstructed and more water can get through larger openings, Pulley said. Defense attorney Andrea Marconi said understanding the size of the storm is absolutely critical to understanding the case. The storm that night caused 23,000 cubic feet per second of water to come rushing down a channel that could only handle 10,000 cubic feet per second. There was so much water running so fast, it couldn't make the curve in the wash, so it breached the wash, was sent into the Cal Palace, which was not only in a floodplain, but in a low topographical area as well, Marconi said. She told the judge the evidence would show the bridge inspectors followed all state and local guidelines. Moreover, she said 144 pages of bridge inspections will show the Sapori Wash Bridge's water adequacy nearly always scored 8 out of 9, meaning that it could handle normal rain events. There was no need to clean out the sediment. Marconi insisted that the bridge inspectors never called for sediment to be cleared out, and she noted that there is a difference between sediment and debris or vegetation. Regardless, the vegetation wasn't cleared out because records will show they weren't considered enough of a problem to be considered a priority, according to Marconi. The defense attorney also said that the sediment did what sediment does during a five-flow event. It washed away and ended up in the Santa Cruz River. Marconi also told the judge that Bertolino is asking for damages, and yet he declined to hire water remediation experts who urged him to swiftly clean up the damage after the flood. And as a result, Marconi said the restaurant suffered even more damage when another storm hit the area 2 weeks after the flood, and damage had continued to compound over the 6 years since. Bertolino, 76 years old, testified he purchased the restaurant, which was built in 1921, for $500,000 in 1987. He said he expanded the 2,000-square-foot, 130-seat restaurant into an 8,700-square-foot, 300-seat restaurant. It was such a favorite of Green Valley residents, groups, cowboys, and ranchers, he was able to pay for all of the renovations with cash, according to Bertolino. When asked if he knew the restaurant was in a floodplain, Bertolino testified he received a mass mailing with a map every few years, and sometimes portion of his land was in the floodplain, and other times it was not. And he told his attorney that he didn't hire remediation experts because he didn't want to dip into his retirement funds. Under cross-examination from defense attorney Douglas Northrup, Bertolino acknowledged he owns two homes in Green Valley worth roughly $1 million, plus a piece of property worth $365,000. At the time of the flood, Bertolino testified he was leasing the restaurant and its furnishings and equipment to Lynn Greens. He had also sold her his liquor license, although he bought that back after the flood. Attorneys played a recording of a deposition Greens gave in December of 2020. She recalled the shock she felt when she and Bertolino drove up on the afternoon of September 3rd to find a double yard dumpster that used to be in back of the restaurant in the front, moved by the force of the water. She spoke about wading through ankle-high mud and water inside the restaurant, finding dining booths displaced, a walk-in freezer unmoored, a refrigerator toppled, and mud marks. The judge also heard testimony from restaurant manager Frank Sabata, Amato Market owner Carissa Vanderhelm, and rancher Joshua Hamilton. All of them testified they had seen the Sapori Wash overflow its banks before that Labor Day weekend. Hamilton testified that he heard trees, some as big as a foot in diameter, snap, and said they sounded like gunshots. 20 minutes in front of 10 o'clock. Green Valley and Sorita will see a three-phase weather system move in that could bring some light and widespread showers through Friday evening, this according to the National Weather Service. Meteorologist Chris Rasmussen said that a dry weather system moving in from the west will bring southwest winds ranging from 15 to 25 miles per hour, gusting up to 35 miles per hour today, which could cause blowing dust. And Weather Service also anticipates temperatures 5 to 10 degrees below normal, with a high of 61 and overnight low of 40 degrees. The second phase will see a slight increase in moisture and could bring light showers to Green Valley. The further south you get, it gets iffier, Rasmussen said. Just some sprinkles or light showers, you know, nothing's going to be very impactful. Friday afternoon and evening will bring the best chance of rain, with 50 to 60% chance of light showers, up to a quarter inch of rain. You can see some puddles or small ponding on the roads, but nothing like what you would see during the summer, Rasmussen said. Despite a red flag warning across Cochise, Graham, and Greenlee counties on Tuesday, Rasmussen said there's little concern for fire weather. Even though there will be stronger winds, the higher humidity sort of means that we're out of the fire threshold, he said. Of course, it's always good to be fire-wise because it has been drier this year. A measles outbreak has tallied 15 cases in West Texas, with a high rate of vaccine exemptions as of Tuesday, but Pima County's vaccination rates remain strong, even amid growing national uncertainty about federal health support in the future. The outbreak in Gaines County, Texas, mostly affects school-age children. The Texas Department of State Health Services reported that 17.62% of kindergartners in Gaines County had a conscientious exemption for at least one vaccine during the 23-24 school year. During that same period, Arizona Department of Health Services reported an 8.9% personal exemption rate statewide at the sixth grade level, 8.7% at the kindergarten level. ADHS reported Pima County had a 5.8% personal exemption rate for sixth grade students, 5.4% for kindergartners during the 23-24 school year. Three of four schools with sixth grade students, Anza Trail Elementary at 8.1, Great Expectations Academy at 13.9, Suarita Middle School at 12.1, had a higher personal exemption rate for the 23-24 school year than the county, that was at 5.8%. Wrightson Ridge came in slightly lower at 5.6%. Crystal Latour-Rombaud, Program Manager for Pima County Health Department Vaccine and Preventable Disease, said that the county does well with vaccination rates compared to the rest of Arizona and the nation. "We always try to do more, and we'd like to try and get those numbers higher," she said, regarding immunization rates, "because we do really need high levels of coverage to make sure that we don't have outbreaks. But yeah, I think we do generally well. I think we generally have a pro-vaccine community here, which I think is great." ADHS tracks multiple required immunizations for school-age children, including Tdap, polio, and MMR vaccines. Tdap covers tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, commonly known as whooping cough. MMR vaccines cover the measles, mumps, and rubella. In Pima County, ADHS reported a 96.7% immunization rate for MMR vaccines and 87.2% for Tdap in sixth graders during the 23-24 school year. ADHS reported a 94.3% immunization rate for MMR vaccines and 80% for Tdap statewide during the same period and in the same age group. Rambaud said it's harder to track vaccination rates in adults because many had non-digital records. Federal reporting requirements are only for pediatric vaccines. And while the county's immunization rates outperform the numbers statewide and in most counties, it does have room for improvement. Rombaud said that some schools and areas around Pima County with more exemptions than others. "We still see that just like any other community," she said. "So yeah, we have our pockets of kiddos that aren't well covered, and we do try and do outreach in those areas, but obviously that can be a challenge." The health department also focuses on vaccine access in addition to outreach. The department doesn't charge for a child vaccine at its clinics or mobile programs. Rambaud said the county will cover the costs through a household's insurance or with federal grant funding. Rambaud also found the coronavirus pandemic also played in the increased vaccine hesitancy overall, but said it wasn't as apparent for county health department clinics since patients go to them for vaccines. She said hesitancy can be an issue when department staff recommended vaccines beyond just those mandated by the state for school attendance. Arizona also allows personal and medical vaccine exemptions. Rambaud said medical exemptions are rare. ADHS reported a 4.4% personal exemption rate in Pima County for sixth grade students during the 2019-20 school year and 6.2% statewide. ADHS reported 5.8% of sixth grade students in 23-24 had a personal exemption in Pima County and 8.9% statewide. Rambaud said the health department isn't doing any extra bracing for immunization effort changes at the federal level, is remaining thoughtful about how to best move forward while trying to prepare for any future instability in federal grants. But she said it's hard to say how anything at the federal level could change the department's day-to-day obligations until there's more information. I think we're also looking at trying to make sure that we're building up and continuing our good trusting relationship with the community, Rambaud said. So if there is more a stage set for vaccine hesitancy, how do we make sure that people feel confident and comfortable that they can continue to trust our messaging even when there might be different ideas about safety and the efficacy of vaccines? It's 9:47 here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Well, subscriber Sophia Schild overheard Lee Loeffner, Lev, tell Green Valley News Circulation Rep. Elizabeth Kilpatrick last week that she had to cancel her subscription. Loeffner said she wasn't able to support her local paper due to the rising costs. So Schild stepped in and offered to cover the tab and keep Loeffner's paper showing up at her doorstep. With eyes moist, that is, the two exchange numbers, and plan to meet for coffee. Kilpatrick said, Sophia Schild, what a wonderful way to pay it forward. We appreciate your love and support for your local newspaper, and we wish the two of you ladies a beautiful friendship. Great story. For La Posada resident Diane Marr, it's never too late to have any fun, try something new, and experiment. The retired property manager and amateur photographer learned how to shoot video with the GVR Photography Club, and almost a year later, Marr is ready to premiere a 15-minute Western comedy about a botched bank robbery, titled Three Desperate Men. We do little skits among us from time to time, just for fun, Marr said of the club. I helped with one as well, and after we were done, this whole movie came to me. I woke up the next morning, and I'd get another scene or another line, so I was just working on it, and when I thought it was done, I gave it to all the guys in the group. Marr joined the GVR Photography Club not long after moving here from Oregon in 2021, and members of the club, including nine who appear in the film, pooled their skills and got to work. They included Kevin May, who is a professional cinematographer, who agreed to help with the cinematography after seeing Marr's script and supplied his own camera equipment. Phil Winstron, a professional sound technician, also agreed to participate and use this equipment. The movie was shot at Harkins Museum and movie set in Tucson. And Todd Taylor, retired business owner and photographer, played one of the main characters. It was a blast, he said. We practiced for it for a few weeks and prior to getting to Harker's. There's nothing like being on set. Imagine being in a jail. Imagine going into a bank and things like that. Actually being able to get there and to do it brought it all together. Taylor had been involved with movie makers and was impressed with Marr, who in addition had been wearing many other hats as producer. I wrote it in April and now we're filming. The team rehearsed every week for almost 2 months. Marr said that nobody in the club, including herself, had made more than 5 to 10 minute videos or even made a video that tells the story. It was challenging, But my crew guys, Kevin and Phil, had my back. They mentored me, really, Marr said, finding people to play the parts. Everybody there is comfortable behind the camera, not in front of it. And it was slow to begin with. It took a while for people to learn what I was doing and get interested in it. And then, boom, it took off. Marr said it took the crew 6 hours of shooting before they came away with 1 hour of film to work with, which was then edited to 15 minutes, with bloopers included, using Final Cut Pro software. Marr said she would consider working on another film product in the future, and for all of us, this was an amazing experience, she said. It's 51 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm going to read a story, part one of a story, of part one of two. It's Meandering the Mesquite, How the West Became, the History of Cattle, Cowboys, and Horses. And this is by Scott Dyke. The image of men on horseback, adorned with holstered Colt 45s, driving a herd of cows has been emblazoned in the minds of Americans since the advent of the motion picture. To the point, the very first commercial film was The Great Train Robbery, which was made in 1903, an adaptation of a 1896 play by the same name. This loosely hinged plot was about a Western holdup, and ironically, the production was in New Jersey. From this genesis, the American West would catch the public's fancy and became the subject of thousands of films. Perhaps the most representative film of cattle drive was Red River, which starred John Wayne. The arduous trip from Texas to Kansas was keenly captured. Of course, as Hollywood is bound to do, there are some distortions for the sake of sensationalism. One would be the pistol-packing cowboy herding cows. That rarely happened. A protruding gun and a holster would get in the way of working of a working cowboy. So how and where did this iconic trio, men, cattle, and horses, how did it become an American legend? Well, you can't have a cattle drive without cattle and horses. The very first introduction of hooves and hoofs was by the Spanish. Ancient pictographs in France and Spain dating back 5,000 years depict both cattle and horses. Before that, the Old Testament, specifically Exodus, speaks of cattle in the field. Both species were not indigenous to the Americas. In the 16th century, Spanish expeditions brought them. The first recorded horse intro was in 1519. Cortes brought 16 horses to the New World through Mexico. A member of the party of the conquistadors, Diaz de Castillo, dutifully recorded the history of the expedition. It is an easy guess that this particular breed of equines were a hardy bunch. Imagine the suffering they endured while sequestered in the bottom deck of a heavy Spanish caravel, pitching and yawing its way across a vast ocean. Del Castillo gave names to the horses and described their demeanor. One interesting example, Baena, a dappled horse, almost black, no good for anything. The horses proved more than worthy. The party encountered hostiles that vastly outnumbered the Spanish, and during the ride and the tide in their favor, the mounted conquistadors charged and scattered their foe, who were fearful of such a strange sight. Custer would have been proud of this very first American cavalry charge. The Narvaez expedition of 1527 landed in Florida, spent 8 years exploring its way west. Of the 80 horses aboard the ships, only 42 survived. DeSoto, in 1538, brought more, and some cattle as well. Speaking of cows, they were initially brought to the New World in 1521. These longhorns became the Adam and Eve of the great Texas herds years later. Coronado, in 1540, brought an astounding 1,000 horses and some mules with him. One has to wonder what poor soul got the duty to keep the holds cleaned on those cramped ships. DeSoto played a major role in populating the West with wild horses and cattle. He traversed through Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Nebraska, and because the United States of America, other Americas became cattle and horse indoctrinated by the Spanish, Argentina being a prime example. Father Kino used the ancestors of these horses in his travels. His many trips included cattle to Arizona, and one significant journey covered 1,200 miles. Along with his mission of converting various Native American tribes, he promoted a rudimentary cattle-raising culture. Kino influenced both Mexican and U.S. communities for 40 years, from his arrival in 1671 to his death in 1711. He rests in Magdalena, Sonora. They have a festival every year to commemorate his life. My friend and colleague, Jane Candia Boyer, an author awarded the Silver Spur Award and a Pulitzer Prize nominee, wrote a classic poem about Kino and has traveled to Magdalena often, where she is held in high esteem. The American West was spawned by three distinct and separate urges. The Spaniards sought their gold, and they needed transportation, and they had to eat. And part two, that I'll be reading next week, is titled The American Cowboy. And that, my friends, will take care of the reading of the Green Valley News for this morning. I thank you for joining me. If you miss a program, you can always get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Just left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Broadcast. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot and other smart home devices. And we thank you so much for listening this morning. I wish you a very, very pleasant day, and I'll see you next week.